Oh my gosh. Welcome to the Biting Lemons bath. Go on if you want to. Try and get it there.
Yes!
Violence in my bath is not permitted. I do not give consent.
You did. You said do it.
I did. You're right. I really am so excited to have you in the bath because I feel like you're going to take me on a bit of an education. The reason I asked you to come in the bath with me is... over time, and what would that be? I don't know, over the last few years, when I have caught your posts in different forums, I've had a whole range of human experiences from them as a reaction. So sometimes I've read what you've written and I've been like, I wish I hadn't read that. Because it means I'm going to have to think about that and I don't want to or feel something and I don't want to right now and I can't, I've got no capacity for this, and I've had that reaction.
Did I have a trigger warning on post?
Maybe.
We could talk about trigger warnings
later.
Because I've got a bit of a bugbear about them, but anyway.
Okay. Then there's another reaction in me where I've been like, oh my word, it's like paused me and I've been like, wow, I need, that's big, you know, that's impacting me right now and I want to be with that impact and it's moved me. There's been other times where you've written something and I've just gone like, oh my God, I can feel her feelings, like, or I'm making a judgment. I can feel your feelings and they're visceral in my body of like, what's going on there? That's big, you know. It's so rare that someone has that kind of impact by what they write and what they share on me or many people, I think, because we just numb out when we're just sort of scrolling past, catching up with a bit of life in between something.
I'm gobsmacked that you're telling me this, because I don't think that anyone sees my posts and that it doesn't impact anyone at all. I feel like my voice goes out there and it's lost, you know, in the noise of the competition for attention.
Right.
And I don't feel it lands anywhere and I feel completely invisible and unheard. So hearing you say that is... really beautiful.
You don't have that impact on me of unseen, unheard. You have the opposite. And you know, there's the reaction of, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see what she's saying. And I'm wondering if maybe the experience you're having is actually you challenge people and you are not afraid to say what's happening, how you feel about it. There's normally a call to action of something, even if it's think about this stuff because we can't keep burying our heads in the sand. And also when you've been sharing about stuff that's really in the live happening for you, I cannot imagine that there are people who are just scrolling on past unaffected by it. I can imagine people burying it under the carpet because they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Because of what it triggers in them.
Yeah.
So that's why I wanted you in the bath. I wanted you to challenge me. I wanted you to teach me. I want to hear about your story. You've got such a story that isn't one I can relate to from my story, from my experience, but it's one I want to know about. I want to not be naive. And I hear the advocacy in you for so many topics that I think are really admirable, and they're topics that I want to know more about.
Okay.
So no pressure.
Let's do it.
I want to start by you sharing a bit about your name. Like, what the hell is your name about? So your name is Beaver Meadow.
Beaver Meadow, yeah.
Which immediately takes me down to a part of my body. Is that anything to do with it?
Well, yes. And no.
Okay.
So I chose that name when I turned 50 because I needed a new name.
You're more than 50?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah, 53.
Amazing.
Postmenopause. Yeah. So I chose it when I turned 50 because I didn't want my ex-husband's name anymore. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want my maiden name, which was my father's name. And I suppose I was coming to... The fullness of my knowledge around the patriarchy and how that was impacting me, and recognizing that I didn't actually have my own identity because I've always had a man's name.
Right.
And I wanted my own name. And it's really hard just to pick a name out of a hat of what you're going to be known by, because you know, a name is quite important. It's how you present yourself to the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I didn't want a serious name, but I also wanted something that really reflected who I was. So for a couple of years, I was nameless, and I'd rock up to some workshops. And, you know, when you sit in a circle and you introduce yourself, I'd just say something glib like, oh, I'm in between names.
Brilliant.
Just call me. Someone said, oh, we'll call you nameless then. So for that entire time, I was nameless. And I actually really liked that. It was nice not being attached to a particular name and identity. And it was almost like something opened in me that a new kind of expansion of possibility of who I could be, not constrained by my birth name and the whole story that goes along with my birth name and the men, the surnames that were men's surnames, all of those stories. So I was nameless for a long time, and I played with Scarlett because I really like Scarlett O'Hara from Gone with the Wind.
Absolutely.
I'll think about that tomorrow. And then I realized that the literal English translation of my given birth name, which is Beverly, is Beaver Meadow.
Right.
Bever, as in beaver, and Lee means meadow in Old English.
Wow.
So then I was like, oh my God, could I actually really call myself Beaver?
Yeah. Like,
and everything that that entails and the double entendre of what a beaver is. And then I had kind of like another kind of expansive moment where I recognised that the actual beaver, as in the animal beaver, not your muff, is a keystone species that creates environments for other species to thrive.
Nice.
And I'm a bit of a space activator. I will go into a space and see how I can make it better, improve it, bring light, bring energy, bring music, bring a nice smell. You know, like pick up the litter, you know, make it usable again, make it beautiful, beautify it.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like channeling the beaver in me who really cares about systems and how systems are broken and where the bottlenecks are, where the dams are. And kind of like I look at life through an architectural lens, through a beaver's eyes, I suppose.
Wow.
Of how to make things flow easier, or, you know, what needs to be dammed up because we don't want to go down that way because that's not a healthy way for us.
Yeah.
So I kind of went, it's perfect. And I was working as a partner surrogate at the time, so I was doing conscious sex work. So it was almost perfect, too perfect. Like, and I don't always introduce myself as Beaver to everyone. I kind of
tailor it.
If I think they can handle it and it will be an interesting conversation, then I'll say Beaver Meadow.
Yeah.
If I want to be a bit provocative.
Yes.
And if I need to be a bit more serious and be taken a bit more serious, then I'll just say B.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you've already said so much that I want to come back on. But instantly I was just reminded of it in The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe, the beavers. And, they were a safe haven, weren't they? They kind of,
Mrs. Beaver.
And they were just such a lovely rescuing place. And they'd made this amazing home by the dam. And so that came to me.
Yeah.
A place of rescue and a place of, safety.
Yeah.
And I also, I just think of a muff, and I think of how we used to just, talk about beaver in not a very nice way, actually. Yeah. And I've just gone through in the last year this journey of questioning why am I waxing so much, and actually starting to grow back my natural ways.
A beaver.
And feeling so much more sensual.
Right.
I feel so much more sensual. And as a friend of mine once said to me, she had this massive bush that I was so proud of for her. I could never grow anything like that. She said to me, she said, I think if the French can do it and the French women can be sexy, so can we.
Yeah. And you know what? How men have their beard month, don't they?
In November or something.
Their moustache and their beard thing.
Yeah.
There should be the same, like similar for women, like International Beaver Day.
I agree.
How bushy can you grow your beaver?
And see what you think of it.
Yeah.
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 So there's that. But also, you've dropped in a few things like partner surrogacy, and I'm just aware that there's going to be some people that have no idea what that means. And at some point, I want to make sure that we come back to that.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to start a little bit, like, in the more recent years, what was your menopause journey like? How significant is that in your journey overall?
I mean, absolutely life-changing. I'm not the same person I was before menopause.
Wow.
And when I say post-menopause, I mean, you know, 14 moons of no bleeding. That's when you're technically post-menopause.
Yeah.
And that happened when I was 50, actually.
Wow.
And at the time, I'd set up a business and I was working as the disability sex coach. And this is where the partner surrogacy, the sex surrogacy
right.
came in. And I was working specifically with people who were marginalized in their sexual expression. So whether that's disability, neurodivergence, incels, mature adult virgins, mostly men.
Yeah, okay.
Some couples, but yeah, mostly men. And working with them consciously and therapeutically in their sexuality and helping them have healthy sexual expression.
Wow.
And the barriers that they face in that. Because most of the clients that I worked with are in some ways desexualized, sexually deprived,
yeah.
medicalized, infantilized, even if they have severe disability.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yes. And so my body was very much part of the therapeutic intervention, working with clients, mm-hmm. working in the space with them. Not always being sexually intimate with them, but often a lot.
Mm.
And when menopause came, it completely shifted what I felt I was able to offer clients. It's like my body just went, no more, stop. Shut up shop. You yeah. can't do this anymore. I was tired.
Well, are we talking about your body or your sexuality?
That's interesting. My body, and as I'm saying that, I'm kind of saying they're one and the same.
Okay.
That there isn't a distinction. My yeah. sexuality doesn't live outside of my body.
Right. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Because there's this cultural expression of sexuality that I've been watching since I've returned back to the UK about how there is this sort of unspoken perception that sexuality is almost like a box that you put on a shelf, and then when you need it, you'll bring it off the shelf.
You get it out and then you get down to it and then you put it back in the shelf again.
And yeah. that it's all related to sex.
Yeah.
So I love your answer, because for me, sexuality is fully embodied. It's an embodied thing.
That's
so.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so it said no more.
I just won that award.
Wow, tell me about this award.
I was...
are we allowed to look at it?
Yeah. This is the Golden Flying Penis from the Sexual Freedom Awards. And I was...
Wow. Winner, Sexual Freedom Awards 2023. Yeah. That's quite a penis, isn't it?
It's quite a penis. And to be fair, you know, I wasn't really happy that was the trophy that I was given to celebrate the work that I'd been doing with my clients. And I actually, I ended up on The Guilty Feminist, on the show The Guilty Feminist,
brilliant.
About this, because she asked, Deborah Frances White was asking the audience what micro acts of feminism we were doing.
Oh.
And at the time, I'd just been shortlisted for this award, and I was feeling uncomfortable about going on stage and being given this gigantic penis as a way to recognise my work professionally.
Were there other options?
No, that's the whole point. There were no other options. There were no other options.
I think I would rather a beautiful pussy.
Exactly.
With wings.
Exactly.
Or a hybrid.
Well, it could be like a Picasso type thing. You could have, like, you know, some boobs. You could have a pussy. You could have a penis. You could have a bum hole.
Yeah.
You could have it all mashed up together like a Picasso.
Have you heard of the artist Alpacha Channeling?
No.
Oh, my gosh. Amazing.
Alpacha Channeling.
Yeah, Alpacha Channeling. I've got their colouring book and it's amazing. And they could create something.
Should we get them
perfect.
To commission
yes,
a new
let's go on
a
it.
New award I for think, the Sexual Freedom Awards?
I think this is a really important point that you're making.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's so patriarchal. I mean, come on. It's just like, you know, we're way beyond that now. Why is sexuality celebrated by a massive big phallus, erect phallus? No, come on, we're, you know. And when I spoke to the judge, you know, the judging panel about it, they said, oh, it's always been this way and it's, you know, funny and it's coveted and, you know, we don't want to change it. And they're handmade in Bali and all this kind of stuff. So okay, they really weren't listening.
They weren't open.
They weren't open. And this is the Sexual Freedom Award.
It's a bit ironic.
It was very ironic.
What do we need to open for us to hear each other to be seen?
Exactly. Exactly. So that was really frustrating. So, yes, I'm really happy that partner surrogacy and disability sex coach got professionally acknowledged and celebrated. But yes.
However, I do love your cock.
I am a bit of a size queen, but even that is a bit much for me.
Definitely. But yeah, it could be good to hang your necklaces on.
I never thought about that. Yeah, I love that.
Maybe.
Or you could hang it bracelets this way, and then you could put your dressing gown on it.
Yes.
Or your coats or something.
Yeah.
I wonder how strong it is. Should it would snap.
No comment. Let's move on.
Moving on.
Partner surrogacy. So that's fascinating. Did you have to go through, I am assuming, making an assumption that you don't just get a client who immediately is ready for touch, for example, or do you have to go through quite some stages before you would work with someone for them to trust you?
Well, every client is completely different and at total different stages of their sexual journey, mm, and their needs, wants, desires are, so different from each other.
Yeah.
Some clients, there's never any physical touch.
Yeah, okay.
It's just a conversation. I might be a permission slip. They might have some issue. Is this normal? They want me to, to normalise it. Before I work with a client, I have to feel comfortable about working with them. And also, depending on what they're wanting to achieve, what their expectations are, what they want to explore, I have to feel comfortable about whether that's something I can offer, because I'm not servicing clients.
Yes.
If they know that they want a specific sexual service, then I'll refer them to a sex worker who works quite differently to partner surrogacy, which is a bit more coaching, a bit more conversation, unpacking.
What was the most interesting scenario that you found yourself in through that work?
Oh my God. So many incredible clients, amazing sessions. I think the one that sticks out the most in my mind, well, there's two. There's the client that actually got this funded by the NHS.
Wow.
I got paid by the NHS.
Wow. That surprises me.
Right? Exactly. And it was part of his care plan that it was recognised that he needed sex coaching, sex therapy, and he started off with talking sex therapy, and then the sex therapist says, yeah, mate, you need to lose your virginity. You're a 30-year-old guy. And yes, you're severely disabled and limited mobility-wise, but that doesn't mean that you can't have sexual expression.
Yeah.
So for him, it was a whole year of talking, of him believing that he was allowed to have sexual expression.
That actually moves me.
Yeah, yeah. He said that he'd been touched by hundreds of hands in his lifetime, medically.
Yes.
But never intimately.
Yeah, or essentially.
Essentially with an ungloved hand. Yeah.
So that is powerful.
So that was a beautiful piece of work. And he wasn't ready straight away. He needed to develop trust with me. And also because of his, his body and his unique physicality and fragility with his bones and his spine, he was very cautious about me even getting near him.
Of course.
Yeah. So a lot of work went into working with that client, and I'm really proud that it was funded. And then a year later, when he applied for his annual funding package, they pulled it and they said it wasn't an appropriate use of public money.
Wow. That's like giving someone a gift and then saying we're going to take it away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could he afford to pay his own way?
No.
Oh.
No. And that's the other thing, isn't it, about affordability, because we make the assumption that we get sex and that it's free because we are able to find a willing sex partner. But what about if you can't find a willing sex partner, and how many of us out there are struggling to find a sex partner?
Yeah.
I mean, it's,
this is a big topic.
It's a big topic. The loneliness epidemic, the incel culture. And, as a beaver who likes systems and who sees a problem and wants to find a solution, working therapeutically with clients with their sexuality, for me, solved a lot of the issues we have around sex work, traditional sex work, and women being trafficked, women doing sex work not out of choice but out of financial necessity, which then brings into the question, well, is it really consensual? If you're being driven by economic necessity, are you really in choice?
Yeah.
The litmus test would be you don't need the money, but you still want to go and work with these clients in this way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your body saying no during menopause. I definitely have experienced already through perimenopause that my body now is the boss of all bosses, and I will not go against her. And if I do, you will pay. So I can hear you on this, and I'm curious about, okay, so your body said no, but that's your, was that your livelihood?
It was my livelihood, but not just that. It was my modus operandi. It was how I moved through the world since forever.
So what do you do with that when your body's saying no?
It was horrific. It was a complete identity collapse. Actually, I did a lot of research online to see if this was a well-documented, well-researched phenomena amongst women in menopause and amongst sex workers, what happens when they hit menopause. And I didn't find hardly anything. But for me, it was a complete identity collapse. Mm. I call it hypersexuality remission-induced identity collapse.
Say that again slowly.
Hypersexuality remission-induced identity collapse.
Wow.
Because that's what it felt like. I felt like I'd lost my identity. I lost who I was, how I moved in the world, how I got attention, how I made money, how I interacted with people, how I related to people. I just, I viewed the world through a sexual lens.
Yeah.
And that was now gone because my body was just saying, I don't want to center sex or relationships or men anymore.
Yeah. So what's the impact on you in that, you know, aftermath?
The impact is I don't have a job. I don't have an income. I don't have an income, and it's not so easy to career pivot when you've been a sex worker, because I can dress it up however I like. I can say I was a partner surrogate, I was a sex surrogate, it was therapeutic. You know, in a lot of ways that conscious sexuality practitioners, you know, differentiate themselves from traditional sex work. But the bottom line, and the way the world sees it is, mate, you're taking your clothes off and you're getting paid to have sex with people. You're a sex worker, you know, no matter how much you dress it up. And according to the government, I'm a sex worker and I have to pay my taxes and all the rest of it. So try putting that in your CV and then getting a job. Yeah, and it's not something I feel ashamed about either. It's something that I'm really proud of, those 6 years, or longer than that, actually, that I was working, and how quickly I made a name for myself and had a waiting list. And and I really knew that I was doing really good work and also bringing the conversation forward around sex, talking about sex, sex in marginalised groups, sex and disability.
I think you definitely, you know, I can recall, you know, those years where you were an advocate in that way. And I know that there would be very few people, pretty cold people, stone dead hearts, who won't be impacted in a positive way from what you used to share. And when I hear you speak now about it, I don't hear shame. I don't hear like that kind of like cringy, crunchy movement inside of you. I just hear like, and I love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've done an awful lot of work around shame. And I think, you know, the reason that I started studying somatic sexology in the first place was because of my own sexual issues, my own personal story with my own sexuality and the shame that I was carrying around my own hypersexuality and my own sexual trauma. So I've had to do a lot of work. And part of the whole point of being very out and proud about the sex work that I was doing was because I'm modelling that sex isn't shameful.
Can you use the word hypersexuality? I know what that means, but I want you to explain it for those that won't know what that means.
Okay, so for me, hypersexuality, it's my way of making friends, like a bonobo monkey.
Okay.
So we have to go a little bit into a bit of a dark place, really, to unpack this.
Okay. I'm willing to go there.
Okay.
I feel like I need to change positions.
Yes, let's change positions.
Yeah. Okay. Let's monkify this up a bit.
Yes.
We can get into a monkey position. Okay.
Okay. So maybe I'll talk generically, or should I just talk personally? I'll talk personally. Should I just talk personally?
I think let's go personal.
Okay. So, so my biological father was my primary caregiver when my mother left our family home when I was three. And it was at that point that he was sexually abusing me. And he sexually abused me for 6 years until I was 10. And then there was a court case.
Right.
So what that did to me and my brain was it taught me that the way that you relate to people, the way that you get close to people, the way that you elicit attention, love, safety, is through being sexual with people.
Yeah.
And I think this is a lot more common than we acknowledge. Mm. I see it around me all the time. I see it not just for survivors of incest or childhood sexual abuse, but I see it as indicative of a patriarchal structure that's conditioned women to be available sexually.
Okay.
That our worth is in ours and how sexually desirable or available we will be.
Mm-hmm.
And so add on the early sexual trauma by a primary caregiver, that's going to set the brain up to be a highly sexualized person, and to go through the world using your sexuality to get what you need, safety, roof over your head, emotional stability, physical stability, housing, like everything.
From the age of 10, therefore, onwards, how does that manifest?
So after the court case, I was shipped off to boarding school for a year and a half, and it was an all-girls school. And it actually was nice because it was a breathing space, bearing in mind I'd grown up in a highly sexualized environment.
Yeah.
So this was the first time that there was no sexual energy in the field.
Was there a grief in that as well, though?
No.
It was relief.
It wasn't even relief because I didn't actually have the awareness or the intellectual capacity to understand what happened to me at that age.
Right.
It was when I turned 13, when puberty kicked in, and I started having sex with the boy next door. And I liked him because he was a year older than me. He was really good at football and he had the cigarettes. So he was going down the council estate football thing and smoking.
Yeah.
And, you know, so part of me of like, I want this guy to like me. I want to hang out with him. And I just do the only thing that I know to do, which is give him a blowjob.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, what my father taught me. And I didn't really process it any more than that. It's just that this is what you do. And it's very grown up. And as I got a bit older and I started to see that my girlfriends at school weren't being promiscuous like I was, because it wasn't just him. I was then, you know, any man really that I came into contact with, I would sexualize it.
And that would they be any stage of man?
Any.
And would the men receive that?
Well, absolutely. And that's what was really disturbing about it, because I'm 13.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is what's going on in my head right now.
Exactly. And I think, you know, my first boyfriend, he was 24 and I was 15. But, you know, we just talked about it and he, you know, years later. And I said, did you not think that was, you know, I was 15. He said, yeah, but you just came across as so mature.
Yeah. And so comfortable.
And so comfortable with this. And I was like, well, doing it all my life, you know. I had to figure out a way of turning my greatest wounding into something that would serve me.
Yeah. Wow.
Because when I realized that I had an issue with sexuality, and back in the day, and this is in the 80s and 90s, it was framed as sex addiction.
Okay.
And you never really heard about it with women. It was all like Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was men going off to these, you know, sex addiction rehab places.
Yeah. Being caught in promiscuous situations.
Yeah.
It was never a woman.
No. So then Sex and the City came on, and then there was Samantha. Do you remember Samantha?
Yes. Yeah.
And how sexually permissive she was. And she was celebrated as a woman who was really in her sexual power, very empowered. And so I went, oh, that's just me. I'm just sexually empowered, you know, with no intellectual understanding of the damage that my brain had actually sustained. And it is actually a brain injury.
Wow. Has there been research into that?
Well, yes, because they recognise that parts of the brain have developed more than other parts of the brain for survival.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there is a little bit of research, but not enough.
Mm.
And all the research that's been done on sex addiction or hypersexuality is mostly on men and their porn addiction.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when do you realise at what point what I went through with my father was not right, was not okay, that was wrong? At what point do you acknowledge that, feel it?
It probably didn't land with me until I was about 14, 15, 16. I remember my school friends saying to me, oh, you're going to be scared of men. You're going to become a lesbian because of what happened to your dad. And I grew up as a Mormon.
Wow. There's so, another.
Yeah. Another okay. You know, layer. So that was even more, more complex.
Yeah.
Because they're incredibly sexually repressed in the Mormon church. And so it's not okay to be gay.
Right,
And so I was kind of like, oh, I don't like the sound of being a lesbian. So I'll make sure that I'm not scared of men. So I will become the initiator, the predator, the manhunter. And I would just go out most nights and go to a bar and just scan the bar and pick the hottest guy and take him back and have sex with him. And then afterwards, I would feel so disgusted, so shame-ridden. It was awful, but I just couldn't stop doing it.
How long were you in that loop for?
All my life. Years, until menopause.
Wow.
And it wasn't actually until menopause that actually then all completely stopped, that I could reflect back on my life and go, oh my God, I wasn't driving that bus.
Yes.
That was trauma. That was sexual trauma. That was brain injury.
Yeah.
That was driving that. And hormones, and now that I don't have the hormones driving that, on top of the trauma,
because
we all have hormones and we all get sexually aroused, but not all of us go out and feel that they have to be promiscuous and fuck every guy they meet, right?
Yeah.
Or women as well. Yeah, it was women as well. I'd sexualize all my female relationships as well.
Mm.
And inevitably, that's really problematic because you can't sustain relationships on that basis.
No.
Maybe nowadays you can with more kind of openness towards polyamory and conscious sexuality, but definitely not back in the 90s.
So people are coming and going regularly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's just also that consumeristic element, which is this isn't about connection. You were looking for connection.
Yeah.
But for the other, this isn't about a connection. This is an experience.
Yeah.
Two very different worlds right there coming together.
And I think the thing that shifted for me was in my 40s, and I was like, okay, you know, I actually went back to the Mormon church in my 20s because we left for a period of time when I was 10. So for my teenage years, I wasn't in the church. That's where I did all my training. We lived in Plymouth in a Navy town.
Okay. Oh,
so
wow.
Every weekend it was going down the strip.
Plenty of choice. Yeah. Wow.
And meeting up with the Marines and the Matlows.
So you were there for those years. Then you returned back to the Mormon church.
And I went back to the Mormon church, and partly as a way to clean up my act. Like, I don't want to be this person, but I can't stop. But if I get deeply religious, where you're not even allowed to have sex before marriage, you're not even allowed to masturbate.
It will save you, right.
It will save me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be able to. And I know that that's quite a common thing for a lot of people that are struggling with hypersexuality.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't work.
No.
It's like an alcoholic. You know, you might be clean, you'd be sober for a while, but you know, you inevitably fall off the wagon unless you do the deeper work.
That's it. So the deeper work was where you needed to go.
And the deeper work wasn't actually, oh, it's something wrong with me. It's like, oh, it's my brain. My brain developed to prime me to be a sex doll, to prime me to be a sex toy.
This is happening for me now. What's tapping on my brain is what happened to your dad? Was it just, these are questions that are coming to me. What happened to her dad? What were the consequences? Did she have siblings? She's seemingly so blasé about this. She couldn't have surely been blasé. There's this noises going off on me. I'm curious, the loudest is, what the hell happened to your dad? How did that come to an end? How did at 10 you get taken from that scenario? Do you feel comfortable to share that story?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where I get really kind of, get my activist head on and get really quite angry.
Are you comfortable if I put my leg here?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
So, yeah, my father, there was a court case. I didn't know anything about it because I was 10. I just gave a statement to the police and then that was all I heard about it.
So but had you told someone?
I hadn't, no. He'd abused, outside of the family, my sister's school friend, and so her mother had told our stepmother. And because it had gone outside of the family, then it got reported
wow.
to the police. And so we were then interviewed. So, yeah, this was back in the 80s where it was still like, you know, two policemen coming into your, sitting in your front room fully clothed in uniform, really intimidating, really scary.
In front of your parents?
In front of my stepmother.
In front of your stepmother?
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a court case and he got charged with multiple indecent assault against multiple minors under 13, so me and my sister, for multiple years. And he got 2 years probation. So he walked out of court. He took a plea deal.
What?
He got released. He just got 2 years with the psychiatrist. Slap on the wrist.
Sorry, I feel like just like swearing.
Yeah.
Okay. And this was quite a shock.
And this was typical of the 80s, though. It was typical that you would not do a prison sentence, that you'd get probation. We didn't have the Sexual Offences Act.
When did that come in?
2003, okay. I think. So these were old laws.
Okay.
And the wording was different. And so, yeah, so I'm coming, yeah. So all of that happened before we have the laws in place now. Not that they're great. I mean, they're better. But that's the problem. So he then, and this was prior to the Sex Offenders Register, which came out in 97.
Okay, yeah.
I think 97. So
he's not known by anyone now. He's not even being watched as such.
Well, it's quite well. He's now actually a 3-time convicted child sex offender. He has been to prison since. He went to prison for 10 years in 2000 and I want to say 3, 4.
Okay.
He got 10 years out in 5. And then I recently found out last year that he had a third conviction and went back to prison and did another 4 years out in 8, 9 months or something like that.
So just help me understand this. That happens to you and your sister and an outside person. Maybe even more, who knows?
More. All the girls in church, because they used to come round for guitar lessons and babysit us.
And you know
and I know about them. I've spoken to them
right.
since. Trying to get them to come forward, but they won't.
Okay. So there's this experience then as a child growing up. He walks away. He's then found guilty and goes to prison for more offences. He's then released again. And then there are more offences and he goes back to prison. And you're telling me he's now still released?
Yeah, he's back out in the community. Been back out since 2019.
Now he will be on the register.
He now is on the register. He's under the PPU, which is the Public Protection Unit. Yeah.
And how robust are those units to... I mean, your father sounds like he's got incredible powers to get what he wants.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, we were estranged from the age of 10 and I didn't see him for many years. He wasn't allowed to be near me and he just disappeared from my life. And I went back to live with my real mother. And we were reunited. And
wow, after she left you when you were 3.
Yeah.
What was it like to be estranged from your father? Because I can imagine that it's not a straightforward relationship. Did you love him?
I did love him.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved him because I was terrified of my stepmother because she had a foul temper and she was quite physical, could be quite violent. And she wasn't my mom and I didn't like her and I was scared of her. So whenever my dad would be there, because they had separated, but he would come and visit and he'd come in his camper van. Whenever I saw his camper van outside our house when I was coming in from school, I'd be really happy that he was coming because then my stepmom would, you know, treat me better
right.
in front of him.
Yes.
Right? So there was that dynamic going on. And, you know, and I didn't, you know, the abuse stuff, I don't ever really remember thinking, oh, my God, again, or I don't know. It wasn't like that. I think I just liked the fact that I got to spend time with my dad one-to-one.
Yeah.
And that I believed that I was special.
Yeah.
And he made me believe that I was irresistible and beautiful and
So he's creating good feelings inside of your system.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So when he's then estranged from you, there's loss there.
Yeah, I mean, it's another attachment rupture.
Yeah.
And I'd already had one with my mother, so yeah. So yes. But then because I got my real mum back, there was a switch over straight away.
And how was that transition? That's quite a thing, isn't it? Did you have any contact with her?
None for 6 years, no.
So she's effectively a stranger to you.
She's a stranger to me. But what's interesting about when I look at my mother's life is she was just as much a victim as I was. And that she left because I really believe that he would have killed her.
Right.
And she had to leave to save herself. And there was no way she could take the three of us. And she actually believed that she was a bad mother. He'd, you know, made her believe that, gaslit her and all the rest of it. So when I was reunited, yeah, I was just really, like, happy to see my mum. And she was really glamorous. And she'd set up her Keep Fit Studios for women doing Jane Fonda workouts. And
this is starting to make me realise where you get your jeans from.
Yeah, she was an incredible woman and ahead of her time and forward thinking. And but imagine you've left your kids, you've left them with a perpetrator who abuses them.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, you've got these three teenagers to parent.
Huge.
And how do you do that? And
yeah.
I remember when she found out that I was sleeping with the boy next door and I'm 13 and I hadn't even started my period yet. She just took me to the doctors and put me on the pill.
Yeah.
I hadn't even started my period yet, but she put me on the pill anyway. Yeah. She was so terrified that I'd get pregnant.
Yeah. And I guess she must have this whole story of her own of what that must have been like to have left you three to then what the impact on her. Now you're back, she's seeing the impact.
Yeah.
And she's got her own impact and all of that in the mix.
That's right.
What a story.
That's right. Yeah.
And so it's you, your sister, and you said three. Who's...
So there's four of us, actually.
Okay.
But my younger sister was adopted out when she was one.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's another indicator, isn't it? Like, you know, if a mother goes to social services and says, I can't cope with my kids.
Yeah.
Have them adopted, like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
You know, there's a file on my family, a social services file, that covers that 5-year period of my sister's adoption. And all of the indicators are there that she was a victim of domestic violence and that there was stuff going on in the home. But she was the one that was painted as, you know, failing, not coping.
Yeah.
And she was told to go out and get a job. So she was out of the home, away from her kids more if she couldn't cope. Or to get nannies. She was sent to her GP to take a tonic. Like, you know, no one actually asked her about her marriage, what was going on in the marriage.
Yeah,
whether
they
she
didn't
was
dare.
Safe.
They didn't dare, did they?
No. But now, you know, and it's heartbreaking because this social services file, the last entry is my father asking social services for money to buy us shoes. And it says, you know, the father has moved back into the marital home because the mother has now left. Case closed.
Oh, my word.
So.
This is a movie. This is one of those movies that I wouldn't actually... I'd be like, they've gone too far. They've gone too far.
I know. It's
And I'm not meaning to belittle what you're telling me. It's just, it's my way of handling
and it's
what you're saying.
And what's really weird, when you said to me, how can you tell it, like, so blasé? Well, when you think about it, this is just normal for me.
Yes.
This is my normal life.
Yes,
It's normal. And so I'm a bit immune to the shock factor of the things that I tell people. And that brings us on to triggers, because for me, I can't walk through my life feeling like I'm a walking trigger, because this is just my life.
Yeah.
And it's taken me years to be able to talk about it without shame.
Yes. Yeah.
And without protecting him.
Yes.
And being able to say his name.
Yes.
You know, and a million other things that I feel I've been silenced about over the years. And so for me, it's just really important that I'm just authentic and I just say it as it is. And yeah, I'm not all upset and I'm not crying. And I have my moments if I get triggered. But generally speaking, I'm just telling you the facts of my life.
Yeah. Because,
yeah.
And it's so refreshing to hear the unapology in it. You're just... you know, this is me. And I think that I, you know, one of the greatest desires for this podcast is for people to really start sharing, who am I? Full stop. There's no apology in that. There's no shame. There's no, I wish I hadn't, or, you know, or you know, my progression stops there because everything ended. No, nothing ends. You live your life. I hear in you this full person. You know, I'm curious as to who, you know, what's your identity now? Who are you now? You know, you've in a way, you've had everything stripped back through this menopause experience, and you're sitting here in the bath with me. I think you're like this stripped back person. Who are you now?
Well, that's the whole point of, like, you know, hypersexuality remission. It's like a drug addict who has to go back to the person they were before their drug addiction.
Yes. When was that then?
But for me...
In
exactly,
the womb! You've got to go back to the embryo.
But that's what's the really scary thing, because there is no pre-traumatic self, because
right.
It was so young.
Yes.
Like, I was built that way. So yes, it is incredibly frightening to go, okay, well, actually, I get to choose who I want to become now. I'm like a blank slate. I know what I don't want.
You're no name.
No. I don't know what I know what I don't want and who I don't want to be. So it's just about whether I have the balls, the courage, the confidence to step up and just be this, like, yeah, me.
Beaver Meadow.
Beaver Meadow.
You really know who you are. Like, you come across to be so solid in your activism, in what you care about, where I hear your voice, how you're impacting me with the things that you share online and the work that you are, you know, you're involved in so many different things.
Yeah.
So I want to hear more about that. Like, what's most alive in you, and how do you sense purpose and meaning through your days?
What's most alive in me? Well, I suppose what's most alive in me at the moment is coming back full circle, and this theme of homelessness and housing precarity, because when you operate your life based around sexual relationships or relating to people, your housing is tied up in that. And it's occurred to me that that most of the places that I've lived have been in partnership with others,
right?
With a partner. I've been married twice, and you know, and I can't remember the amount of homes that I've invested in, that I've built with somebody, only to have that taken away from me, or I've had to leave. And
because the relationships fail.
Because the relationships fail, yeah. And you know, that the common denominator is me. Okay, so I don't know, maybe it's who I pick, or I don't know, whatever. We could, you know, talk about that until the cows come home, but that's not really very productive line of questioning. It's more about the fact that when you're a survivor, when you're an incest survivor and you don't have a family, you don't have a safety net, you're out in the wilderness on your own, you know, and that's really difficult. And it's even harder as a woman, and even harder as a mother and a single mother, because you have to raise your children and you have to pull in the money and keep a roof over your head. And I don't know how women have achieved it, because I've never been able to achieve it, except the only time I ever made a living wage was in my sex work.
Mm.
And when I think about that as a postmenopausal woman, that makes me angry. It makes me angry that that was the trajectory,
yeah, well,
that
word,
that was laid out for me, that I couldn't even see coming. And I, you know, and I see that in patriarchal systems, that, you know, many women follow that same pathway because we are disadvantaged economically, especially when we become mothers and we have kids to look after, and
yeah,
you know, relationships break down. So I think what I'm reflecting on now is I'm now living back on a council estate.
Amazing.
I've just been, I've calculated that in the last 10 years, 50% of that time, I didn't have a permanent address.
Wow.
I was living on a boat on the river, which, you know, it was great. It was amazing. And I've lived in some incredible places and had an unusual life, and did a lot of traveling and lived in my bus with my daughters, traveling around Spain and Portugal. And, you know, all of these resourceful things that I did.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't afford rent because I couldn't. It's actually, yeah. It's not even, Beth, it's not even that I couldn't afford rent. It's that I couldn't get a guarantor sign the fucking the paperwork for the landlords to have their insurance.
You probably could get the rent.
But
it's the system of getting it. So relate to this. Yeah. This is our biggest pain point, you know. And I also relate to, we've been resourceful, like really resourceful, and we've had an amazing adventure. But what's underneath it? We had no ability to buy a property, to put down roots anywhere that we wanted to, because for our finances, we had blows in our life. And the blows have meant the housing of our, you know, greatest need has never been met.
Yeah.
And so I really relate to the fact that what you're sharing with me isn't, whoa, we've had a terrible time, but actually at the core of how you feel safe and stable is to have a home, isn't it?
Yes.
So I really, really resonate with this. This is the first time. So throughout the entire conversation so far, I've been like, wow, this is so external from my situation. And now I can really, really come into this connection on this point. And I feel it.
So when I look at the systems around housing and how that works, it's all about insurance.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, you need a guarantor. You need 2.5-3 times the rent to be able to get a tenancy agreement for the landlord to take the risk on you. And if you haven't got a guarantor that's going to, you know, put up the rent money if you default.
Yeah.
I mean, who has a guarantor that's earning 60,000 a year, which is what is needed if, you know, you're looking for a 2-bed flat in London. That's what I needed.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get it. So I ended up being homeless and eventually the money ran out and then the council housed me and put me on a council estate, which was my worst nightmare because that's where I started.
So I'm kind of, this part of me wants to dive into what does it mean to be homeless and the impact on there. But I'm just so aware that you are actually involved and doing some really great things as an advocate and to help us become more aware. And I want to know more about those things. Like, tell me about your play, for example.
A homeless beaver doesn't really, you know, do homelessness. We do it in style. So I found a really cheap Airbnb in Wales, in the middle of Wales, in the middle of nowhere, and hunkered down for a month and wrote a play.
As you do.
As you do. I wrote a play. It's called Dead Men Don't Rape.
Dead Men Don't Rape.
Dead Men Don't Rape. And it is based on my life, and it documents the confrontation that I had with my father last year when I went to visit him.
Whoa!
Yeah. Where I had for a year tried to get him known in the press. I really wanted more victims to come forward. I wanted him back in prison.
Okay.
I could not and cannot still square with the fact that he's 3 times convicted with this offending history spanning 5 decades. He was also an associate of Jimmy Savile.
Right.
He was also a parish councillor. He was also a porter at a psychiatric hospital. And I can't bear the fact that he's out in the community and that I'm illegible for information about him. The only reason that I know anything about my father from being 10 years old is because I've made it my business to find out.
Right.
And I've done extensive research and freedom of information requests and like writing letters. But I'm ineligible for the victim contact scheme because in my case, he didn't go to prison. And the cutoff is that your perpetrator has to have gone to prison for at least 12 months for you to be eligible for notifications about if they go back to prison.
Goodness me.
If they go back to prison, if they when they get released from prison. So
you've had to really shout for this.
I've had to be really clever and really find this information.
Do you feel like you've almost gone mad with it?
Absolutely, I have gone mad with it. And
like an obsession.
Yeah, people say I'm obsessed.
Did it make you unwell? People say you're obsessed.
Yeah, people say I'm obsessed.
What do they want you to do?
Oh, let go, move on. It's in the past, forget about it. I'm like, but that's the problem, isn't it? If we all just move on, forget about it, then paedophiles and perpetrators can carry on doing what they're doing. They would rely on us for being silent, moving on, letting go.
And at the moment, more than I can remember in many years, it's louder than because of the Epstein files and you know, and actually other cases that seem to get quieter than this, you know. But how is that impacting you now? Because that must be even more activating for you.
Well, in a way, it's vindicating because, you know, these are things that I've been talking about for many years, you know, shouting into the wind. And yeah. now at least I feel like other people are on the same hymn sheet as me. I don't feel alone anymore. I feel like finally everyone's caught up.
And how? What would you say is the reality of this scenario? Because I feel that we've potentially had our head in the sand a little bit.
I mean, I've been saying for a long time that we live in a paedophilic cult, death cult. That the problem is far worse than we could ever imagine, and has always been this way. And
there's this part of me that's going like, when I read your post, sometimes I'm like, I don't want to hear what she's saying. I don't want to hear it because really? It's going to ask me to engage a part of me that just doesn't want to, you know, I want to pretend this doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's difficult hearing you say that.
Yeah.
But I'm not wanting to sweep it under the carpet. So keep going and challenge me. So yes, okay.
So, I mean, let's take a wider view, a more global view, and take it away from my personal story and look at the Mormon Church, for example. Mm-hmm. So what people don't realise about the Mormon Church is that it's actually, even though it originated in America from this American guy, the Mormon Church has grown off the back of the British women being breeders. 55,000 women, British women, young, middle, working class, mostly uneducated and poor, were trafficked to America in the 1800s. On privately chartered ships, never saw their families again, were promised the promised land to join the saints in Zion. And when they got there, they were married off to become polygamous wives and breeders to become the next, you know, load of tithe payers to keep the church going. You know, in today's language, we would absolutely call that trafficking.
Yeah.
You know, if a bunch of foreign men landed in England and 50,000 women suddenly got on boats and went to another country, never to be seen again.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of them dying on the crossing, some of them dying on the trek across the Rockies. We wouldn't be celebrating that and be calling them pioneers. We'd be saying they were trafficked women.
Yeah, or allowing it to be okay under religion.
And what was interesting at that time is that this was all heard in Parliament, and you can read the archives on the Hansguard, because the British public were up in arms about the Mormon missionaries taking the young women. And Parliament decided that no crime had been committed because the women were
consenting.
Well, they were just promised a better life and they just had a carrot dangling. So they didn't actually were, you know, really consenting.
Yeah.
And as soon as the ships left British soil, it was out of British jurisdiction. So then nothing could be done.
Mm.
So, you know, when I think of it like that and think about the Mormon Church today and how huge it is and how rich it is, it's like one of the richest religions in the world. And they have incredible power, and yet you never hear anything about them.
Mm.
We just think that they're this like weird little offshoot religion in America.
I literally watched a documentary last night in bed on this.
Did you?
Yeah, and I said to Sam, is it just in America that is all happening? We were like, of course it's not.
No.
Of course it's not. But sometimes you can believe that from Netflix. Everything's happening over there. I'm aware that we've started two subjects and we've started a third. We're being very ADHD right now.
We're going all around the houses.
Can we come back to... Well, I want to make sure... You met your father last year. I want to talk about that. But I want to come before that. We were talking about your play.
Oh, my play.
So you wrote it in a cottage in Wales.
Yes.
And the premise of the play is...
So it's a confrontation between a daughter and a father, and her inner battle to make the decision of what's to be done when justice isn't served, who carries the burden and what do you do with it?
Hmm.
Yes.
I want to see this play. So you've submitted it recently.
Yes.
Who to? What would I say?
It's gone to the Verity Bargate Award at Soho Theatre.
Okay.
So, yes.
Fingers crossed for that.
It is pretty hard-hitting. It is true story, though. And it deals... I mean, I see on social media all the time how vigilantes who unalive perpetrators are hero worshipped.
Right, yeah.
You know, and thousands of comments and, you know, bring back the death penalty and castrate them and all of these things. And I'm very interested in what's happening socially now that we are getting to grips with the issue and the anger it's evoking. And then, you know, people want blood. People want blood. And I've had to come to terms with my own murderous rage and patricide ideation around my father, because I'm sorry, three times back out into the community, justice clearly isn't working. It now falls down to me to do something about it. Well, what can I do about it? How can I make it safe? How can I make sure that he's not offending? Well, the only way that I can actually really make sure that he's not offending is either get him back into prison, which I tried, nothing happened, or I unalive him myself. And that is horrific to live with that. You know, and to actually get to a point in your brain where you think that that is your only course of action left to make the community safe, that is a horrific burden to carry. And that's where I got to last year. And so, I think it coincided with the me turning 52, which was the age that my mother was when she took her own life. Yeah. And so it was like, yeah, so this whole thing about turning 50, changing my name, giving up survival sex work, and then stepping into actually, what is the real issue here? Oh, the real issue is this unfinished story with your father.
Mm.
And what are you going to do about it?
So what did you do?
So I went to visit him.
Where? What, can you say where he was?
Yeah, in Hampshire, in Aldermaston.
Does he, what kind of like life is he living?
He lives with his third wife. They live a peaceful, happy life, doing the gardening. He talks very openly about his convictions. He's very religious. He believes that he's been forgiven, that God has forgiven him, and that everyone else should forgive him. That everyone makes mistakes. That he's not that man anymore. Yeah.
So he's been advocated by the Mormon Church?
No, he was kicked out of the Mormon Church back in the 70s.
Oh, right. So he's gone into Christianity.
Yeah, he's kind of like some... talks about the rapture a lot, waiting for the rapture.
Okay.
Yeah, so born again Christian, yeah. I think.
And he's at peace, do you think? He's made some kind of peace.
It is... yes, he has made some kind of peace. I mean, it's completely delusional. It's Delulu, isn't it?
I mean, what's fascinating to me is where does he place you and your siblings? You know, where in his psyche are you?
Yeah, well, I asked him that.
How was the answer?
And he said he never meant to hurt us. He loved us. He lost his faith at that time. He lost his compass and he succumbed to temptation. Yeah. I'm very interested in what makes a paedophile. Because if we can figure out what makes a paedophile, we can stop it before any victims are harmed. We can intervene.
What do you think makes a paedophile?
Well, I've done a lot of research. I've done a lot of studying about it. And they say that it starts in childhood. And depending on your earliest sexual experience that you then reinforce through masturbation will then set up the need for that similar stimulation. So they give an example of playing in a playground, coming down a fire pole. The boy comes down first. He looks up. The girl comes down and he just sees her white panties and he gets a spontaneous erection. Could be 5, 6, 7 years old. And as he goes into puberty, obviously there has to be a few other things, like maybe he's not socializing very well with his peers, or maybe there's some other issues that's making it difficult for him to relate to his peer group. He will then replay that arousal in his mind and reinforce it with masturbation over and over again. And yeah. Then it becomes a necessity that they have to have that. And then they seek it out more and more. It seems quite basic, really. It seems quite obvious.
So then I immediately go to, well, let's start talking about it much more explicitly, a lot more earlier.
Well, exactly.
Sexuality in general. And
exactly. I think that every every teenage boy, when they have sex education in school, that that these themes are discussed.
Absolutely.
You know, and that if you're having these kinds of thoughts, or, you know, masturbating to this kind of material, that, you know, that you need to get some support and help for it.
It's something we're not talking about.
It's
it's so not needing to be shamed or shrunk. We just need to talk about it, understand it, and then guide into healthy cognitive responses and spiritual and mental and emotional and the whole rest of it. Why are we still not doing it? What are we so frightened of, do you think?
I asked my father the first time he abused a child, how old was he? And he shocked me and he said he was five.
Five?
He said five, and I said, how old was she? And he said she was a couple of years older. And I said, that's not abuse, that's kids
playing.
Being kids. Who framed it in a way that made you feel shame about it? That then that got then repressed and then turned ugly, and then, you know, you needed to continue that.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought...
Could he hear you?
Could he hear me? I don't know.
I'm so amazed that you were able to have this discussion with him last year, and that you were able to sit with him, and that he was receptive.
Well, I went there to kill him, actually. I mean, I know that sounds really alarming, but I'd kind of got to the point in my head where I went, do you know what? I really don't know what I'm going to do when I get there, but I can't live like this anymore. I can't live with either feeling suicidal myself, you know, like my mother, following my mother's pattern, you know, turning it inward on myself.
Yeah.
Because doing nothing is not an option.
Yeah.
So it's do something about him, you know, do nothing about it. And then find a way to be at peace and just get on and live with your life. I just couldn't figure out. So I had come to the conclusion that I might just have to go there and just do it. And I'd really researched that. And I know this probably sounds really alarming, but I'm not the only woman, or, you know, the only person who has these murderous thoughts about unaliving a predator who, you know, who's abused you or your children. And yet that's another thing that we don't talk about. I met a woman who unalived her children's perpetrator and went to prison. And he was let out on bail, and he lived a couple of doors down from her, and he had abused her boys. And they'd let him out on bail, and he had 24 previous convictions, and they let him out on bail back into the community where her boys had to see him. And, you know, it can take a year for a trial to come. You know, she went to the police and she said, you can't let him out on bail. This isn't fair. She tried every avenue and nothing, you know, changed. And so in the end, she went and she stabbed him. And what was crazy is that he didn't actually die of the stab wounds. They were just superficial wounds. And so when she went to court, the judge was very sympathetic, and she had... the world behind her.
Yeah.
And they wanted to acquit her, and she got charged with manslaughter, I think.
Yeah, right.
But then within 28 days, anyone can appeal a sentence as unduly lenient. So we don't know who, but it was appealed, and she went back to court, and her sentence was doubled, and she was charged with murder because she went with a weapon. So I'm thinking, okay, don't go with a weapon. Just go there.
You're thinking there's a kitchen cupboard somewhere.
Just go there. Just like, you know, just go there. And it was bizarre because we had this very weird conversation where he said, why are you here? Have you come to kill me? And I said, I haven't decided yet. And I opened my bag and he said, have you got a gun in there? And I went, don't be stupid. That would be murder. But this lamp here, you know, and I got him into a place where he knew he had no power, and yeah. I had power.
Yeah.
And then I knew that he... was on the back foot, and then I could ask all the questions that I wanted to ask and tell him all of the things that I wanted to say. Like, you ruined my sex life.
Yeah.
You stole my orgasm.
Yeah.
Because every time I get close to orgasm, your face comes into my head. Every time. That's the legacy. These are the things that we don't talk about. We go, child sexual abuse, horrific, what happened to you as a kid? But we don't really talk about how that continues to play out and the ripple effect that has on you as an adult. In your sex life, in your employment, with your mental health, with your housing. It actually impacts everything.
I am so stirred by... I'm imagining you there. I've imagined the sofas and the chairs and the decor. It's all my assumption. I cannot even start to let that land in me right now. That I feel stirred by it. I feel you are incredible.
What's really funny about
it? You are incredible.
Just in case the viewers are kind of being like, oh my God, you know, she's talking about murder and all this. I did go to my GP in the summer and told my GP I was having patricide ideation and suicide ideation and I needed help. And they referred me to community mental health and they put me on the waiting list.
I bet you still haven't been seen.
No, I have been seen. No. It is documented.
I also had dreams about certain people that were murderous. You know, I remember also picturing the men, the male faces of the men that hurt my parents, and we lost our whole kind of way of life. And I used to picture these men in my head and just have murderous feelings. Shall I say, I didn't plan to murder them. I had murderous feelings.
Yeah.
So I think this is a very human part, and I have worked with hundreds and hundreds of people who have had all levels of that kind of ideation. I'm not sending them to the emergency mental health team. What I want is the conversation to get more real between us. You sitting here today, being as real as you are, is enlivening to me. I feel inspired, I feel challenged, I feel that this is everything that I want us to be able to do with each other, is meet in the reality of our story unapologetically and learn and grow and expand and go and meet the conversation with said person, said people that have it.
Yeah, we don't have very good models for repair. After rupture, do we?
Again, another thing in schools would be wonderfully placed to teach us.
Yeah.
After rupture, where do you go?
Yeah. How do you repair it?
Yeah. I'm mindful that you dropped into the conversation about your mum's suicide. Do you feel like you want to share that, or do you feel at peace that we don't cover that?
We can if you want to, if you have time.
I have time, yeah. I'm just curious because that's a big piece.
It's a big piece, and it's also being reflected in social media at the moment, because aren't they bringing a law in where if a victim of domestic violence takes their own life, that the perpetrator can be prosecuted? That's now a thing.
Oh, I do not know about this.
Yeah, that's now a thing. And when I calculate the damage done by my father, there are 7 of his victims that have committed suicide. 7.
So now can that be something that can be...
They're 7, but they're dead, so who can speak for them?
Of
that's
course.
That's the thing.
There's no advocate.
You could say dead men don't rape, but you can also say dead women don't tell.
Right.
You know, and so it's so common for survivors to suicide. And whether they do it shortly after or years later...
Do you want some water?
It's incredibly common. And
well,
again,
I guess also it's very complex because we can't say of all the factors that are contributing to their suicide.
Mm.
So it's like a minefield, isn't it?
Yeah.
And no one wants to touch it, I swear.
Yeah, and I actually raised that with my father as well. And I say, you know, what about, you know, mum and auntie blah blah and da da da. And he said, oh, that's got nothing to do with it. Their suicides were years later. And he actually, you know, he couldn't see that that would,
was a relationship.
Would be an, yeah. Would be a factor in them in doing that. And the pattern for me was breaking that pattern. And part of breaking that pattern was no more survival sex.
Yeah.
No more hypersexuality.
Yeah.
Not continuing the pattern of violence.
Yeah.
Neither. So,
yeah.
Actually,
so there's no murder.
I went there going, in my mind, I could do it, but when I went to do it, my body just really wouldn't let me do it.
Yeah.
And because it wasn't driven by revenge or anger,
yeah,
it was driven by I need to make the community safe. And because I couldn't be 100% sure that he was still perpetrating, I couldn't justify doing it.
I get it.
If he had told me that he was still doing it... We probably wouldn't be here. I'd probably be in prison.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's a horrible thing that I have to carry. Like, it shouldn't be down to me to be the community enforcer to keep the streets safe.
No.
So, you know...
You can't take that on.
No.
That's a weight beyond all weights.
But if I hadn't have kept a track of him, then I would not know that he's 3 times convicted and back out into the community, right? So...
Yeah, yeah.
And when I think about that, he's 3 times convicted back out in the community, how many others are there? And there are thousands in the UK. I mean, there was like 78,000 on the sex offenders register at the moment.
Just want to say, how did you end that conversation, that time with your dad? Has that changed anything significantly for you? And I just want to touch upon your mum and anything you feel to share about that particular story.
I don't have patricide ideation anymore or suicide ideation anymore. Mm. So something has settled within me. I think writing the play was instead of... It's like I'm not going to perpetuate violence. But I also can't just leave it alone.
Right.
But yeah, I can create some art.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, share some of these themes or raise this issue through art. So in a way, that's kind of keeping that moral dilemma, which it is. It's a complete moral dilemma. I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't.
Mm.
Damned if I do something, damned if I don't do something. So that's keeping that at bay. And in terms of my mom, I think I feel like I'm doing it as much for her voice as my own, because she didn't have a voice. She didn't have a voice, and she was one of his victims, and she's dead. And I do it for the other victims as well, who have ended their lives. It was just too much for them to bear, and they don't have a voice now either. So I feel that's probably where my activism comes from.
Yeah.
Because it's not just on behalf of me, it's on behalf of those other women that he harmed.
Mm.
And I, yeah.
Do you have something that you want to say as your, to the listeners that will be impacted by your voice and your words today? Is there something you want to say to them? Is there a message right now?
I would say try to give yourself a lot of compassion, a lot of grace, a lot of time. We're all on different stages of our journey. We're all traumatized. We're traumatized because we live in a patriarchal society. And yeah, just a lot of compassion and grace for yourself.
Mm.
A lot of patience with yourself. A lot of kindness towards yourself, because none of this was your fault.
Mm.
And, you know, and that's the very first thing they say in therapy, isn't it? It's not your fault. Mm. It's like, yeah, but it feels like it is, because I was groomed to believe that it was. Mm. So, you know, how do we get my brain to learn that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know of places where people can go for support specifically for childhood sexual abuse?
Oh, my God. So, yeah, I mean, there's loads of organisations out there, like loads, so, so many. I personally have not found much support there for one reason or another. It very much feels like I don't know, I'd like, we don't need another helpline. What we need is survivor-led reform. Helplines, everything's available online now, isn't it? So you can just, you know, scroll at 3 o'clock in the morning and come across, you know, self-help.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's millions of podcasts and millions of organisations with all sorts of information and books written and self-help books and therapists and everything. For me, the work is around being in groups where I feel emotionally safe.
Mm.
And I think that that's across the board, regardless of whether you're an incest survivor or what. Finding community where you feel emotionally safe in your vulnerability is pivotal. And I think we're all struggling to find that. And I don't think you're going to find that on a website in a specific organisation.
No. And as a conversation I had yesterday with someone was, if it's not there, we must start it.
Yes. We have to build it.
I literally could talk another 3 hours with you.
But then we'd all be all pruny and wrinkly.
I'm starting to feel it.
I'm getting pruny and wrinkly.
Yeah. I'm so grateful for the time, the sharing, the openness. I'm so aware that we need another bath. I am moved and stirred, and I feel like I need to let this land over the next day or two. And how are you feeling right now?
I feel great. I feel fine. I usually have a delayed
you'll feel it tomorrow.
Reaction
yeah.
to things. So yeah. I would probably get on the train and post-mortem this and go, oh my God, what the fuck did I say? Did I really say that? Oh,
a vulnerability hangover.
I will have a vulnerability hangover probably.
But you're very welcome to have one.
That happens less and less as I get older. There's something really beautiful about getting older because you really do not care as much as people think.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, look at me with my grey hair growing out. And,
beautiful. Love
you know,
it.
Not giving a shit.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So I like that. I think growing old is great. I'm definitely enjoying my 50s more than any other time, even though it feels like my 50s have been almost the most frightening. Yeah. But it's like coming to the end of the year of the snake, and shedding everything and then going forward with the fire horse, isn't it?
On the horse, yeah.
Who knows what's going to happen this year?
Exactly. So with the horse, with your penis award, with a cold bath and wrinkly hands, we'll say thank you very much for being here. And I look forward to seeing you again, where we're going to talk about what can we do about it.
Yes. Thank Brilliant. You, Beth.
If you're ready to deepen your relationships and learn how to show up more authentically in every part of your life, we really encourage you to check out ART, Authentic Relating Training. It's available worldwide, online and in person, and you can get a nice discount through our affiliate link. We've all done it. It's incredible. It's changed the way that we live life fully. And if this podcast matters to you, your support genuinely keeps us alive and it helps us create this space. You can find everything that you need, links and details and discounts, on our website or in the bio below. Take care.